Previously on Beta.
Give me. I need.
Give me, please.
Nazis had UFOs as early as 1930.
Those UFOs have been rummaging around the earth, bothering country folk in their nightgown.
It's not his will that you and I live falling into temptation.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, journalist Mark Jacobson introduces us to the grandfather of conspiracy theories, Milton William Cooper.
I mean, this is everybody from Tupac Shakur and the Wu-Tangs and everybody has either quoted or mentioned Bill Cooper in his book, either in their raps or in the interviews that they gave.
Also, Chris Difford, co-founder of the British rock band Squeeze, joins us.
When I first met Glenn, I was very impressed with his ability to play guitar and his incredibly sweet voice. It kind of was a good balance for me because I played very rough guitar and I had a very rough voice.
And Beta's own Steve Gotcher and Carl Christensen put on their fashionable yet functional Beta lab coats for a rock and roll thought experiment. More rock and more talk. But first, Helen Phillips. She's a short story writer and novelist. Her latest book is called The Need. It's a subversive thriller about a young mother named Molly. One night, Molly is home alone with her two young children when she thinks she hears footsteps coming from the next room. Molly goes to investigate, and she comes face to face with a masked intruder. So begins Helen's genre-bending tale of the vulnerabilities and triumphs of motherhood. She joins us now to reveal the inspiration behind the book.
Well, The Need began from a very small moment that happened to me when I was nursing my first child, my daughter, and she was a few months old, and I was home alone nursing her. My husband was out for a few hours, and I thought I heard a footstep in the other room. It was no one. The moment passed, but I clung on to that feeling I had in that instant of just almost animal instinctual fear of what would I do if someone came into my home right now when I'm here alone nursing my child who is so vulnerable. That sensation, I felt like I have to write about that. And then the other source of inspiration for the book was when my own daughter was 8 weeks old, my older sister died. She had the rare neurological disorder Rett syndrome, and she died at the age of 32. And so that summer when I was feeling the bounty of having my newborn and then the grief of losing my sister and holding both of those feelings at once really led to the duality you see in The Need.
And your sister, her name is Catherine Rose Phillips.
That's correct.
And you dedicate the book to her. Is that why your protagonist in The Need, Molly, has two children rather than just one? Is it kind of, in a way, a tribute to you and your sister?
I love that way of thinking of it. I hadn't actually conceived of it that way, but I feel like having the sibling is so important. A sibling, in a way, is a doppelganger of you. There's so much you share with your sibling, mm-hmm. and doppelgangers are obviously a theme throughout the book. And also, I wanted Molly to be in a situation where she was very responsible for two children who were at very different developmental stages. So the stresses of caring for a baby are very different from the stresses of caring for a four-year-old. So I wanted you to feel that intensity of both of the children's needs upon her.
Can you give us a brief synopsis of The Need without revealing any major spoilers?
I'll try to, because I did put a lot of twists and turns and surprises. The book begins with Molly home alone with her two young children, and she hears an intruder in the other room. As the story goes on and she discovers the intruder's identity, it really shakes everything that she believes about her own life and her own identity and her own day-to-day existence. Another thing you should know about Molly is that she is a paleobotanist. She studies plant fossils, and at the site where she works, they have recently been discovering some very strange artifacts, including an alternate version of the Bible. So the personal crisis of the intruder in her home and the professional crisis of these strange objects that are causing a lot of controversy end up colliding in the book.
Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt from The Need, and you can set it up. That would be great.
This is after Molly has heard the footsteps in the other room, and that situation is about to come to a head. She asked her daughter to get a bat from the closet so that she could protect them. But her daughter, rather than bringing the baseball bat that Molly was picturing, actually brings a toy stuffed bat. So at the beginning of this chapter, she's going to throw that bat on the floor. Here we go. Molly threw the bat on the floor. "You hurt Batty," Viv said, stricken. She grabbed Viv's hand and started pulling her down the hallway back toward the closet so she could get the baseball bat and guard the children at the same time. Viv resisted her, bare feet planted on the wooden floorboards, her skin squeaking with each of her mother's yanks. "You come with me right this second," Molly's scream whispered. "But there's a deer in our coffee table," Viv said. And there was. The lid of the coffee table had been thrown back on its hinges. A deer head floated above it. The deer head wasn't floating. It was just that its wearer was standing in a dim living room in a black turtleneck and black hoodie and black pants. It took Molly a second to account for the sensation of simultaneous surreality and familiarity that overwhelmed her. It was her deer mask, David's birthday gift to her. Her milk came down again, more insistently. He had made it out of paper mache and spray painted it gold. The mask, which covered the entire head, had a slender snout, narrow eyes, sharp antlers. She gripped her children as though the three of them were poised at the edge of a cliff, wind whipping around them, pebbles giving way beneath them. She could not move. She did not know how to pass through the next seconds of her life. By some impossible sleight of hand, Viv slipped her fingers out of Molly's grasp. The child's motion broke her mother's stillness. Molly cried out twice, once at Viv and a second time for help. But Viv was already stepping away from her, was already reaching to retrieve something from the deer's black gloved hands, the Y book.
That was great, thank you. And that's such a powerful image that you conjure in the reader's mind, that this intruder wearing this deer mask head that Molly's husband had made for her. That's actually on the British cover of your book, isn't it? The British version?
It is on the British cover. I think it's a very bold cover. I love both of my covers, but they're so different.
And it's interesting, those words that came up in the passage you just read, surreality and familiarity, because those kind of like are two major things that you explore throughout the book.
Yes, that's certainly what I was aiming for. I'm glad that that landed for you, because I really wanted to show mundane, familiar moments in life, like a kid's birthday party or making breakfast for your children, and then undercut that with a sense of surreality and also dread.
Alexandra Alter wrote a story for the New York Times recently about how literary fiction is borrowing from the horror genre to explore the fears and anxieties of motherhood. Your book is mentioned along with Karen Russell's Orange World and a couple of other books. Do you think this is just coincidental, or do you think that there's something happening in our culture right now that explains this trend?
I think that's a fascinating question, and I don't really know the answer to it. I think that one thing is that in terms of genre, I feel like literary fiction is opening up more to the possibilities of borrowing from other genres. I wasn't thinking of horror when I wrote the book, although I understand why people see it that way. I also think that you could call it a thriller of sorts. It has elements of speculative and science fiction. Mm-hmm. Someone even recently told me that it read to them like a ghost story. So I think there's an openness now to using different genres in fiction. I also think that maybe there's another answer to that that has more to do with our current moment, that the anxieties you feel about global warming, which is such a challenging adversary, you can't reason with it, you can't negotiate with it. It's just something that's happening that we're all implicated in. I think that that can lead to a sort of nebulous anxiety. And maybe also that we live in a post-Columbine, post-Sandy Hook world where you feel like even schools themselves aren't the places that feel as safe as we want them to. So maybe some of those cultural anxieties slip into these books.
Both you in your novel, The Need, and Karen Russell in her title story, Orange World, have made tremendous use of your imaginations to show us how scary motherhood can be. Why do you think motherhood is so scary?
Well, I think that part of what we're working against is the image of the glowing, happy mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found motherhood to be a very wondrous and ecstatic experience, but I also found that it has a lot more terror and dread than I was prepared for, just because the love and the dread go hand in hand. The more you love and cherish these vulnerable people, the more you worry about something happening to them,
mm-hmm.
and the more anxiety that brings. So I just feel like being able to come out and acknowledge some of those darker or more anxiety-producing aspects of motherhood, it was something I felt compelled to do. And I was wanting to read, when my children were young, I craved books that acknowledged all of the different aspects of motherhood, both the joy and the dread.
In The Need, you quote from the Bob Dylan song, Shelter from the Storm, and you include the phrase, burned out from exhaustion, from that song. And it made me wonder how you were able to find the time to write The Need when you have these two young children.
Burned out from exhaustion was the state in which I wrote The Need. So that quote was very appropriate. I do take a particular pride in this book because it's the first book I wrote start to finish since having two children.
Congratulations.
Thank you. That feels like a very meaningful accomplishment.
It is.
I also teach. I'm a professor at Brooklyn College, so I would usually write it for 1 hour a day. I set a timer and I write for 1 hour a day. So after my children are off to their activities of the day and before I teach my classes or grade my papers, I would set aside 1 hour and I would just write it as quickly as possible during that time. So I think that in the short, urgent chapters, that writing process might be in the texture of the book as well.
Yeah, I think it is. I'm curious about your writing process. How did you transfer the story of The Need from your brain to paper?
So my writing process for this book and for all of my books begins as an enormous list of images, overheard lines of dialogue, newspaper clippings about interesting things, dreams that I've had, strange things that my kids say, and I make an enormous list that's completely chaotic. And so the next step of the writing process is then to sort those images and scenes and lines into outline. Sounds a little more grandiose than it is, but into some, create some kind of order for those. And when I'm writing the first draft of the book, I call it my zero draft, because it helps me to take the pressure off and to realize this is just the raw material from which the book will be crafted. So the first draft, draft zero of The Need, was much longer than the book itself. And then once I have the zero draft, I carve out from that so that I really allow only what matters most to remain.
You've said that if it goes off the rails, and the zero draft usually does, you let it, right? You just let it go wherever it wants to take you?
I let it go, and I take a lot of joy in that zero draft because I say yes to everything. There's something really fun. It's like flying. It's very liberating, knowing that I'm going to have to button it all back in later on.
When you're writing the zero draft and then you come up with stuff that, oh, that never even occurred to me, does that happen quite a bit, stuff that you'll come up with plot points and things that will end up being in the finished product?
Yes. And that's part of the reason that I permit the zero draft to be so expansive, because you do discover things that way. And for all of the, for every 10 things that maybe cause the book to go a little bit off the rails, you might discover one thing that will become a central, crucial element of it.
Yeah. What kind of images were percolating in your brain when you were preparing to write The Need?
So there are a lot of them, but I'll just give a small sampling. One image is the image of two pennies lying side by side, and one of them may or may not be from our world. So looking at two pennies really closely and comparing them. Another image is there's a scene where she describes a cast that was made, a plaster cast of her daughter's hand, which is reaching upwards, that looks to her like a memento mori, but that her daughter is very proud of. And that image of that plaster cast hand, which I may or may not have one of in my home, that is actually a plaster cast of my own child's hand. And the image of the deer mask, rising out of the coffee table from the scene that I read to you. So those are some of them, but I really do begin with images, and other writers have told me they begin with plot, or Karen Russell, I recently went to her book launch, and she says she begins with setting. Some writers begin with characters. So it's fascinating to me all the different ways to go about this impossible task of writing a book.
Mm-hmm. When will your children be old enough to read The Need?
That's a scary question,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I wonder what they'll think of it. My 7-year-old, she can read, and she's heard the first chapter, which she seems to find very intriguing. I don't know when they'll be old enough to read it. I'm certainly nervous for them to read it, but I also hope that when they do read it, what they take away from it is my best articulation that I could give of how ferociously I love them.
Helen Phillips is a novelist and the author of The Need. You need to go to WPR.org/beta to find out more about Helen.
He said that the beginning sequence of 2001 with the monkeys or the Neo Men or whatever they are, and the monolith is really a metaphor for the Garden of Eden story.
Journalist Mark Jacobson on conspiracy theorist William Cooper. That's coming up, along with Chris Difford of Squeeze and a rock and roll thought experiment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. These days, it seems you can't go anywhere to escape conspiracy theories. Log on to any social media platform, and odds are you're going to discover someone's tinfoil hat ideas. So we started wondering about the history of conspiracy theories, which led us to a guy named Milton William Cooper, who published a book called Behold a Pale Horse in 1991. Pale Horse is Cooper's collection of conspiracy theories. It's somewhat of a handbook in certain circles and is one of the most popular books among prisoners in the American penitentiary system. So says journalist Mark Jacobson. He's the author of Pale Horse Rider, William Cooper, The Rise of Conspiracy, and The Fall of Trust in America. Jacobson discusses the strange bedfellows that make up Pale Horse's audience, including rapper Old Dirty Bastard of the Wu-Tang Clan Collective. He was a big Bill Cooper fan.
The Old Dirty Bastard connection is the thing that really is fascinating, because Bill Cooper, that book, Behold a Pale Horse, became in the middle 1990s and still to this day one of the most read books in the prison system of America, especially on the East Coast.
Why do you think that is?
You know, when you're reading that somebody's out to get you, and every single one of these little things that is screwing up your life is really being planned by some kind of force that's determined to get you. This is something that means something to people and that feel like they're being oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the rappers, I mean, every rapper that you've ever heard of, I'm sure, from the early 1990s on, I mean, this is everybody from Tupac Shakur and the Wu-Tangs and everybody,
yeah,
has either quoted or mentioned Bill Cooper in his book, either in their raps or in the interviews that they gave. The most important thing that I've heard was told to me by Old Dirty Bastard himself. Several years later, I talked to him. I was working for New York Magazine. I went and interviewed him. It was like shortly before his death. And I reminded him of this incident when I had seen him. He said, oh, yeah, Bill Cooper, Bill Cooper. Yeah, I remember Bill Cooper. You know what Bill Cooper does? In this world, everybody's out to screw you, you know? And Bill Cooper, he tells you who's doing it. Hmm. You know, and when you're somebody like me, that's very valuable information.
Yeah.
So that was, that kind of summed it up for me. And I talked to guys like Prodigy, who was in a band called Mobb Deep, who was a very famous rap group from around here. And, you know, I asked him, is it true that you read Behold a Pale Horse 4 times? Is that really true? He said, no, that's not true. I read it 6 times. So he said, I wasn't going to go up there and talk to the people unless I had that right and exact, which is a 5%er phrase, if you know what I'm talking about.
I do, yeah.
For the 5%ers, they're a group of kind of black, they call the poor righteous teachers. You know, many, 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 many rappers consider themselves either 5%ers or sympathizes with this movement. They're really the people that have carried Bill Cooper forward.
Like William Cooper, who told you the pale horse is the future. Would you
My audience, surprisingly enough, is basically right libertarians and hip-hop people.
Just getting back to his book, Beyond a Pale Horse, for a moment, didn't in that book Cooper actually predict school shootings?
He does. It was actually kind of smart the way you put it. He said the excessive prescription of drugs like Ritalin and Adderall and stuff like that to progressively younger and younger children is going to produce this school shootings.
Beyond a Pale Horse was published 8 years before Columbine.
Yeah, it was before Columbine. I mean, that's the thing about Bill Cooper. He's half a prophet and he's half a huckster. You know, it's half this kind of like apocalyptic belief system about what's going to happen in the near future and P.T. Barnum. I call him the P.T. Barnum of dread. He's so articulate about this and he's so kind of knowing about it. That's the difference between him and somebody like Alex Jones. I mean, Alex Jones is, you know, he's got a gimmick and he's pushing it. Bill Cooper isn't, for all the fibs and all kinds of stuff he told about his personal life and stuff like that, he was an honest guy. You know, he basically told you what he thought. He would occasionally push certain things if he knew that they were popular because he's trying to make a living, you know, on this radio show.
But Cooper was fascinated by Stanley Kubrick's film 2001: A Space Odyssey, and he actually said that it was the key to everything that has ever happened in the history of man, everything that's happening now, and all that was going to happen in the future. Can you explain what Cooper was talking about?
I think that's a mild overstatement, but not completely. Cooper was obsessed with trying to figure out things he couldn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
He would work on it and work on it and work on it until he came up with a theory that he was satisfied with. It goes along with his famous comment about do your own research, read everything, believe nothing, until you can prove it with your own research. So the idea, like he sees 2001, and everybody who saw 2001 at that time, including myself, just walked out of the theater like completely blown away, as they say. You know, he thought about it and thought about it and thought about it and came up with, I think, is really maybe his most kind of fascinating theory about things. He said that the beginning sequence of 2001 with the monkeys or whatever this, the Neo Men or whatever they are, and the monolith is really a metaphor for the Garden of Eden story.
Hmm.
Because in the Garden of Eden, what God tells Adam and Eve is you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So when the monolith comes down and sits there, and is sitting there, and the monkeys are kind of like, ooh, looking around, trying to figure out what it is. And then one of them, he touches it. Whatever it is that creates consciousness in human beings, it clicks over at that moment. As soon as he touches the monolith. And then, of course, in Cooper's version, the first thing he does is kill one of his fellow species members. That is the kind of beginning of mankind on a downward track, because he's always seeing things in terms of good and evil. So if the monolith is really planted there by, say, for lack of a better term, the devil, he traces this idea of the nature of evil.
He hosted a radio show which he broadcast from 92 until November of 2001. It was called The Hour of the Time, and it has what you say is one of the most arresting sign-ons. Can you walk us through the opening of The Hour of the Time, how it starts?
I think you should just play it. I mean, I'll never be able to give it justice. And it says, lights out for the curfew of your body, soul, and mind. And then you hear this screaming and yelling, and like, you know, it's like the time has come. You didn't listen to what I told you to do, which is like, you know, be a mental prepper. Not necessarily that you're supposed to get all this stuff in your basement and do all this stuff like that, but you're supposed to be prepared to understand what's about to happen. That's what Bill Cooper wants to tell you. And if you're not listening to him, you know, he feels like, well, just screw you. You know, I'm telling you what you need to know. And if you don't bother to listen to me, it's your own fault.
And I'm telling you, be prepared for a major attack. But it won't be Osama bin Laden. It will be those behind the New World Order who once again want to take the guns and the freedom away from the American people, because we're the only ones left in the world who can oppose the destruction of freedom in the world and the implementation of a one-world totalitarian socialist government, and that is the goal. And whatever is going to happen that they're going to blame on Osama bin Laden, don't you even believe it.
Cooper predicted 9/11. It was just a few months later that he was killed, November 5th, 2001. Can you talk about that, what happened?
The part of the Bill Cooper legend, which I like to call it, is that he predicts 9/11 and they killed him for it.
Do you believe that, though?
I believe some of it, yeah. I mean, I'm a Bill Cooper fan. You know, I'm on his side, kind of, even though he said a lot of outrageous things, you know. The things that his followers say and the stuff that he said are not necessarily the same thing, you know.
So take me back to November 5th, 2001, the last day of Bill Cooper's life.
The legend is the feds came up there and shot Bill Cooper dead. But that's not really the case. I mean, most people who know anything about it don't say that, but that's the legend. And actually, Bill Cooper was not shot dead by the federal FBI or anything like that. I mean, he was indeed a tax cheat, or if you want to call it. They claimed he owes taxes. He claimed he didn't have to pay taxes. So there was a federal warrant out for his arrest. So the feds decided that it wasn't worth it to go up there and bat him, because Cooper lived on top of a hill. What happens is the Apache County Sheriff's Office is another jurisdictional police force that is in this area. They go up there. Well, what they're going to do is play a lot of loud music and have Cooper come out of his house to chase him away, and then they're going to pinch him. But Cooper doesn't really play ball that way. He comes down in his truck as opposed to on foot. They, I think, bungle the entire thing. And the whole idea is not to let Cooper back into his house, because then he's going to supposedly be shooting at them and it's going to be some awful situation. So Cooper gets back up to his house and they're not going to let him get back in. Two officers approach him. Cooper, he's carrying a .38. And he turns around and this is in dispute. You know, it's what the police report says, is that Cooper turns around and shoots one of the officers twice in the head. And then the other officer fires on Cooper and kills him. So that's what happened to Bill Cooper. The thing about it was, after he had been saying, "You'll see, they're going to come up here and shoot me dead on my front doorstep at midnight." He'd been saying that many times. So they did come up there and they shot him dead on his front doorstep. And it was like 10 minutes after 12. So he missed by 10 minutes.
If Cooper were still alive, what do you think he would make of the current political situation here in the U.S.?
That's an interesting question, I think. I think that Cooper would be just appalled by what's happened. I mean, he's a constitutionalist. He's a believer in the Supreme Court is one of these kind of things that you have to have faith in, and it's got to represent everybody, and it's not supposed to be political. If Bill Cooper was still alive, at least off everything I've heard from him, I think that he would feel that this was a kind of logical progression of what he considered to be the secret hand of evil that was moving along to put these people who really didn't deserve it into power, and they would kind of roll the ball further down the road towards fascism. And I don't know. That's just my own personal opinion, but people can argue with me about it, but I mean, that's the way I think.
Mark Jacobson is a journalist and the author of Pale Horse Rider, William Cooper, The Rise of Conspiracy and the Fall of Trust in America. Find out more about Mark and William Cooper at WPR.org/beta.
I'm the sort of person who gets to some fantastic place and then I look at the horizon and I want to get further towards the horizon. I can't sit still, really.
Chris Difford, the co-founder of the British band Squeeze, joins us. Plus, a rock and roll thought experiment. That's coming up on Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Chris Difford is the co-founder of the British rock band Squeeze. The band became popular during the new wave era of the late 1970s and has had many hit songs, including Tempted. Chris is out with his memoir. It's called Some Fantastic Place, My Life in and Out of Squeeze. He shares how he met his Squeeze partner, Glenn Tilbrook.
Well, I put the ad in and I waited 3 weeks for somebody to call. Nobody did. And then eventually Glenn Tilbrook called. And for the last 46 years, we've been writing songs together. It's been quite some journey. And when I first met Glenn, I was very impressed with his ability to play guitar and his incredibly sweet voice. It kind of was a good balance for me because I played very rough guitar and I had a very rough voice. And so it was a great sort of balancing act.
I think it's fair to say that you're a bit on the introverted side, whereas Glenn is very much an extrovert. How have these personality differences created problems for you in both your personal and professional relationships, or have they?
Well, it's taken me quite a considerable amount of years to respect the fact that we are very different. But when I investigate any relationship in the music industry, be it Simon and Garfunkel, or Jimmy Page and Robert Plant or Roger Daltrey, Pete Townsend, everybody that has the creative wherewithal to want to form a band and take it somewhere really amazing. That journey is shared when you're younger. It just becomes harder the older that you get because you have families, you have different responsibilities, you have different points of view. You get tripped up by the different curbs of life. So mm-hmm. I think, there's always going to be differences just in the way that personalities are. But the ultimate sort of goal, I suppose, is just to deliver quality songs. And if you listen to the new album, you'll definitely hear that.
Yeah, the most recent album is called The Knowledge, right?
It is.
Yeah, that's a great album. And yeah, it's great that you guys are still putting out great music all these years later. So you wrote the lyrics and Glenn wrote the music. Can you talk a bit about what your working relationship was like?
Well, it's always been very distant. I've always, up until very recently, just given Glenn a whole chapter of lyrics and he'll go off and write the music to it. And it's very exciting to wait for the songs to come back to be heard. And on the most recent record, we went through that same process after all these years. And suddenly I download, six new songs and they're all amazing. So things haven't changed as far as our writing is concerned.
Going back to 1979, this is when Squeeze released its second album called Cool for Cats. And unlike a lot of bands, your band did not suffer from a sophomore jinx with this second album. The album contained 4 UK hit singles, which I believe is more than you've had on any other Squeeze albums. And so I'd like to talk to you about a few of the songs from Cool for Cats, starting with Up the Junction, which is one of my favorites musically and lyrically. It's terrific. Can you tell
Fantastic.
Me about how you came up with the lyrics for Up the Junction?
I don't know. I was bored. I was sitting outside our hotel on tour, on a very first American tour, and I was thinking of home and what home represented to me, and I wrote that lyric on a piece of paper, and before I knew it, it was a song.
Alone here in the kitchen, I feel there's something missing. I beg for some forgiveness, but begging's not my business. And she won't write a letter, though I always tell her. And so it's my assumption, I'm really up the junction.
I've read that you don't like this phrase, kitchen sink dramas, used to describe your lyrics. Is that true?
No, that's not true. I'll take any phrase you like.
Yeah, okay, because I think it's...
Kitchen Sink's good.
Yeah, I think Kitchen Sink is really good. Another great song from the Cool for Cats album is, of course, Goodbye Girl. Can you tell me about this song?
Well, it was influenced by the first American tour, and, we used to do it in a kind of rock and roll way, like Rockpile would have done it.
Ah.
That kind of...
More rollicking, Chuck Berry on acid kind of tempo thing, yeah.
Yeah, so it was very much influenced by that kind of... the lyric is kind of neither here nor there in the history of Squeeze songs, but I think the overall excitement of it when we play it live, it's a song that you just can't get enough of, you know.
I met her in a ballroom, her name I didn't catch. She looks like something special.
Although if you slow it down, it sounds like the theme tune to The Muppets. It is actually a very original tune, and it was made even more so by the percussion on it, which at first I just didn't understand what all the fuss was about, trying to make it sound like Can or Kraftwerk, but Glenn was definitely ahead of the spin.
Yeah, and wasn't it Glenn's idea and also your drummer, Gilson Lavis, that they used unorthodox instruments for the percussion, bits of metal, empty vodka bottles, isn't that right?
I think there was a great joy in emptying the vodka bottles.
I'm sure there was, yeah.
Yeah,
definitely. So, and Goodbye Girl is one of many songs that features that trademark Difford and Tilbrook octave apart harmonies, which is a huge part of the Squeeze sound. How did those come about?
Just by accident. Glenn was playing some songs in his bedroom, and I just started singing along, and I just, because my voice is lower than his, it kind of, that's how it fitted. But as well as that, I've never really been one for harmonies. I've never been able to hear the root notes very, very well. Huh. And so academically, I suppose you could say it was easier for me just to take the bottom root and stick to it. You know, how I wish I could sing like Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
One of the things that's most remarkable about Goodbye Girl to me is the lyrics, the song being about a con artist. I'm curious about why you wanted to write about that. Were you reading a lot of noir fiction at the time?
I was reading a lot of Damon Runyon.
Oh, okay.
Which I still love. In fact, I just got two antique versions of his books.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, his storytelling is just sublime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to ask about one more song from Cool for Cats, but before we move on to other things, the title track, which of course features you handling the lead vocal duties. What inspired you to write this one?
Yeah, well, it was kind of influenced by the meter of a Benny Hill song. You know, it's not a lyric that I would have on my gravestone, but it's quite fun, and it sort of defines Squeeze at that time. It definitely defines my career because I sing it every day of the year, pretty much. But it is what it is.
And meanwhile, at the station, there's a couple of likely lads who swear like as your father, and they're very cool for cats. They're cool for cats.
I think it was a wise decision on Glenn's part to not go in a Boots Randolph yakety sax direction with the music, wasn't it?
I don't know. I would have loved that.
It would have been interesting.
It would have been fun.
Yeah, it still may happen. We'll see. So
we'll see.
Forgotten what I've had, and everybody tells me that it's cool to be a cat, cool for cats.
In May 1981, you released your fourth Squeeze album, East Side Story, which was produced by Elvis Costello and engineered by Roger Bacharian. And then, of course, there was one track produced by Dave Edmunds. This is considered by many to be your finest album. Can you tell me how Tempted morphed into the soulful Motown-esque version that we're all familiar with?
I think you have to put that squarely at the feet of Elvis Costello, who masterminded the recording of that song and that album, really. And it is one of my favorite Squeeze albums, if not my favorite Squeeze album, because it tells a story all the way through almost. I'm very proud of the lyrics, and I think you can hear the ambition of a young band going in the same direction, and I think that's a really great thing.
Tempted by
I have to ask you about one of the most beautiful songs lyrically and musically in the entire Squeeze catalog, Labeled With Love. It has this lovely kind of country and western vibe to it, yet it's still got one foot in pop. How did Labeled With Love come about?
Well, yet again, it was down to Elvis Costello. We had the song on a cassette and we played it to him, and we were ambivalent about recording it. We were kind of nonplussed, but he said, no, you got to record this. This is just like the bee's knees. So we did it, and there it is.
She unscrews the top of a new whiskey bottle and shuffles about in her candlelit hovel.
I've read that your mother absolutely loved that song, right?
She did love it, you know, and a lot of mothers love that song. I do it on I've just been doing it on my tour, my solo tour. I don't sing it as beautifully as Glenn, but I managed to put across a rendition, which is kind of, you know, Hank Williams-like, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and the story's about the end of a relationship after the war, isn't it?
It is, and age, about what happens when you get older, yeah. So the past has been bottled and labeled
with love. The past has been bottled and labeled. You write very candidly in Some Fantastic Place about your battles with alcohol and drug addiction over the years. Can you point to one turning point that has allowed you now to be sober for 25 years?
My turning point was very much to do with not being able to handle being in a band and not being able to have a day without alcohol. And the alcohol was confusing my relationships, particularly with being in Squeeze. So it was making the waters very muddy. And emotionally, I was kind of drifting.
Mm.
And then when I got clean and sober, we recorded Some Fantastic Place, which again is a brilliant album.
Yeah.
And I think we raised our game there, and Glenn was on top form. The songs were brilliant. And I guess if any of the Pink Cloud of Sobriety were to be heard in Squeeze, it was on that album. A smile could lift me from the pain I often found within. She said something I won't forget. She made a few bells ring.
Would it be fair to say that you've now arrived at some fantastic place in your life?
Yeah, I think I'm the sort of person who gets to the some fantastic place and then I look at the horizon and I want to get further towards the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
I can't sit still, really, because my imagination flares up and I start to work. And I'm very lucky like that. I mean, you know, I could sit in my chair and just fall asleep all day and not do anything, but I think the idea of just leaving as much of yourself as possible as a writer is a good thing, whether it's good or bad or indifferent. That's all I really wanted to do, was tell my story about my life. Fantastic.
Chris Difford is one of the founding members of the British rock band Squeeze. His memoir is called Some Fantastic Place, My Life in and Out of Squeeze. Head over to wpr.org/beta to find out more about Chris. Have you ever wondered why some songs fade out? Beta producer Carl Christensen did, so he and music director Steve Gotcher investigated this rock and roll thought experiment.
If you want to rock, you gotta break the rules.
It's just a shame you missed out on rock and roll. It's over.
I hope we pass the audition.
Thought experiment.
And there used to be a way to stick it to the man. It was called rock and roll.
The pop song. It's often a catchy tune with a beat you can dance to and a chorus that burrows into your brain whether you want it to or not. The pop song usually starts out with a catchy little riff, then it follows a pattern of verse, chorus, instrumental, chorus, or something like that. And then there's the ending. Now, the ending can vary, unless you're AC/DC, who ended every single song, well, like this. Sometimes it's the classical cold ending, kind of like the end of a symphony. Or there's the cold sustain. Then there's the surprise awkward cut ending. Which, by the way, begins with the end of another song, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Then there's the fade out. We here at Beta's Rock and Roll Thought Experiment Laboratories, RARTEL, wanted to find out about the history of the pop song fade out. After some serious experimental thinking, we found that the first musical fade-out may have happened as early as 1916.
That was in Gustav Holst's The Planets.
That's Bill Weir, a music and technology writer who studied the history of the fade-out.
Holst wanted to capture this by having the sound of the singers fading out. And, of course, they had to do this live. And so the way they did that was they had the choir singing behind in another room, and they would gradually close the door as they were singing and bring the sound to a eventual silence.
So what did the Holst fade sound like? Well, it goes on like that for a while, so just imagine it fading out. We thought that that way of fading might have some other uses. Maybe in the workplace. Oh, hey, it's beta host Doug Gordon.
Yes, yeah, Steve, where are we at on that fade-out piece?
Well, I'm just about
to... We have to have everything buttoned up and...
That's great.
...and ready to post by early this week so we can give it
okay.
a big push on social. And we have to...
Okay.
Steve?
Oh, hey, that works really well. As time went by and technology evolved, new methods to fade a song were developed.
They would actually have the recording equipment handheld. It was very heavy at the time, so they would be very clunky. And while the musicians were playing, the person holding the equipment would actually walk away from the performers.
And then the big advance in fade technology came with the advent of the volume knob.
These go to 11.
That was a lot easier for the recording engineers, and it also sounded a lot more realistic.
So the years fade in and out, and pop tunes end with a fade from time to time, which leads to the golden era of the song fade out, which starts right around...
the 1950s or so.
But fade out a song? I mean, why not just do the old shave and a haircut ending? Or something. Why fade out?
Once they realized that they could do it very smoothly, very easily, and had a nice effect because they would go on the radio and they could transition from one song to the next. Just a nice effect to it. And the DJs liked it a lot. Allowed them to, as one was fading in, they could kind of talk over the fade out.
We got to close it out. That's it for the Wolfman Jack Show for tonight. Be back again tomorrow night. Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Gonna suck it to you tomorrow, baby.
Soon, it isn't enough just to fade out the song. Bands start getting creative with fades, in some cases using it to cover mistakes, like the Beatles on 1967's Magical Mystery Tour album. Once again, music writer Bill Weir.
Strawberry Fields was actually, there was a flub toward the end of it, and George Martin faded out before it got to that mistake, but then he liked the stuff that came after it so much, he decided to fade it back in. People loved it, and they figured the Beatles did it, you know, on purpose. There was, you know, it was all like an artistic statement on their part, not realizing it was just George Martin sort of getting around a mistake. Occasionally, you'll see people taking liberties from that. Life During Wartime, Talking Heads, that's where, you know, usually you fade out during the chorus. Everything that you've heard, you've pretty much heard before. But in this case, David Byrne, the singer, he's actually singing an entirely new verse as it's fading out, which, you know, makes you wonder, like, how many lyrics are there to this song? I mean, does he just go on forever and ever? Could he still be singing this song? Maybe psychologically in some ways we actually perceive it that way. I think there's actually a study where they had subjects listening to one song and then the same song again, the only difference being one has a cold ending and the other has a fade out. And they would have them tap along to the beat. And with the cold ending, they would actually stop like maybe about a second before the song itself ended. Whereas with the fade out, they would keep tapping 2 seconds after your complete silence. So in their heads, the song had kind of lived on beyond its own physical self.
Out of my head, it's growing.
The fade out began to lose favor with producers, and so the early 90s saw the beginning of the fade out apocalypse.
In 1993, that's actually when psychologists had the need for closure scale, which happens to be about the year when cold endings start to sort of encroach upon the fade-outs. You know, shortly around that time also was the introduction of the iPod. That made it much easier to skip ahead to the next song. You know, with all these digital devices, our attention spans were getting shorter. So rather than, you know, wait out the last diminishing few seconds, why not just click onto the next song?
But what hope is there for folks who just like a good long fade out?
My sense is that we just wait it out. It's just a matter of fashion, and eventually it comes back. So if you like the fade out, my sense is, you know, I'm remaining optimistic about this, that it will come back.
Hell crash.
Hang in there.
We will, Bill. And not that you asked, but my all-time favorite fade-out, if I had to choose one, it would be, what's that tune called? It's off their second album, you know. It's got that cool riff that kind of goes, how does it go again? It's by that band, you know.
That was Steve Gotcher, Beta's senior rock and roll thought experiment correspondent. He spoke with writer Bill Weir about the history of the fade-out. Fade in to WPR.org/beta for more. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Helen Phillips, Mark Jacobson, Chris Difford, and Bill Weir. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
You don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle.
Special thanks to producer Carl Christensen.
So casual, like a house mouse.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Too much Cal Davis. We overthink things, you know what I mean?
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Come on, be a little bit more like me. Be a little bit of a jerk. Right. Yep.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
But I support this guy. You know, I think that's what needs to be said.